I have this wonderful picture of the Mikesell family lined up outside the fence at the time I did my balloon trip. So some photographer took Mary and all the children there. And I still recall the night before I left town for getting ready to go on the balloon. The balloon trip required all of my time and thought for a matter of 6 months or more in preparation for it. And the night before, I woke up and Mary was awake. And I asked her why she was awake. She said, "Well, I was just thinking." I said, "What are you thinking of?" She said, "Well, I was thinking, what would it be like if something happened?" And of course, I knew what she meant. I didn't realize until after it was all over with, and I began to get acquainted with that balloon man, balloon flight culture, hadn't realized the extent of the risk. And before the scientific ballooning business was dropped, I watched one failed balloon flight after another. Mine was the last manned flight to extreme conditions that was undertaken by the military. The Air Force was into this also, as well as the Navy. And mine was the last one which went off essentially almost perfectly. It wasn't perfect for one bad miscalculation of the pilot, Malcolm Ross, but on every other feature it was perfect. We took off, we landed, and nobody was hurt, and everything was done relatively smoothly. And there were some results, significant results from it, but trifling compared to what was anticipated. And the anticipated results were lost because we had just not fully covered all the conditions that were going to be involved. Flights following it. The next one, was a closed gondola and it bounced and the man was badly hurt. There was another one in which the man's made a mistake within his gondola and created living conditions inside the gondola that almost killed him, and another one in which Malcolm Ross and a companion went to the highest level that men had ever gone in an open gondola flight. They went to over 100,000 feet elevation. And they killed the observer in the recovery operation, and that was simply a frantic, terrible mistake on the part of some elements of the Navy who were involved directly.
Well, that's also where they changed from using harnesses to nets for recovering people, because astronauts, they use nets.
Yeah. And then the Air Force ran a series of tests, every one of which was a failure, essentially. There were some other unmanned tests that were run that were successful, but the failures outnumbered the successful ones, and eventually the whole business was essentially dropped, as far as I know. There were some corporations trying to cash in on this business. One of them made it his specialty. They were both of them. The other one was the one that managed my flight, and that was Honeywell. It was not Honeywell, but the people that do Cheerios.
Kellogg's?
Not Kellogg, but the other cereal manufacturer, and I forget now. But anyway, their management of my flight botched our flight and made for troubles, but that's beside the point. They mismanaged it. But the best story of these failures, the most delightful one, the Air Force was attempting to run manned flights. So they were using gondolas and wanting to go to extreme elevations with enclosed gondolas. And until they could get control of the running of the system, they were using, not putting people in them, so they weren't risking human lives in their flights, and their flights were all failures. But the most delightful one, when the balloon burst and the gondola kept falling down from some high elevation, like 60, 80,000 feet, it hit on top of a tree in the Sierra Mountains, and the tree went up through the middle of the gondola, and one of my friends, related to all to this ballooning experience, one of my friends told me that when they opened the door to the gondola, the inside was packed as tight as you can imagine with toothpicks. The Soviets had tried to run a flight, and the S-9 people, you have your manholes for entering your gondola. The gondola in general is going to be a sphere, like the bathyspheres used in the deep sea, simply so as to be able to maintain an air pressure inside the gondola that's comparable to sea level while you're in a down to just a few millibars of air pressure at the highest levels. And so your manhole cover is a door on the inside of this thing, and of course by the time you're 1,000 or 2,000 feet up in your flight, inside pressure is great enough to seat that manhole cover tightly in place, and you don't really need any bolts around the edge. And this is a fact that isn't as self-evident as you would think, and people keep designing these things with numerous bolts around in order that this plate would be sealed, drawn down uniformly against the thing. And so then you get in the situation, your balloon bursts and you're starting to plummet toward Earth, and you need to get this cover off of there so that you can evacuate your people inside. And fortunately, on the American run, where they're up against this problem, why, the guys inside the gondola recognized the silliness of all those things around there, and they never tightened down with all the bolts they were provided. They supplied with four, and then as soon as they were wheel aloft, they had essentially removed those so that they could get that cover off in a hurry if they had to evacuate. And sure enough, they did. Their balloon burst and they had to evacuate. They're plumbing it down. Well, they had the two trained astronauts, balloon observers for their flight. But then the officer, the Air Force officer, I guess it was, in charge of organizing the flight, thought, this looks like too much fun and too much wonderful publicity. I am going to go along too. And they hadn't been, of course, no part of the whole venture had been designed for having a third person there. It meant they challenged the air recovery system and everything. But there the whole silly business was. He was insisted on going on, and then this failure was presumably in part just on account of having added him to a flight that wasn't designed for him. And when it came turn to, he outranked the other guys, so he has to go first, and he got scared stiff in the as he was halfway out, he went head first out of the hole, and then he looked out and saw what was happening, and the wind, of course, was tearing by at 150 miles an hour, and he froze, and the guy behind him put his foot on his butt and shoved him on out of the hole so that the other two guys could survive. And the joke was that the footprint of the boot was still on the man's pants when they landed. And, we had a big cargo balloon between our gondola, which was an open basket, not much bigger than this tabletop. I sat at this corner, Malcolm Ross sat at this corner, the control panels, this corner. All around the edges were storage batteries and tanks of ballast. But you can picture, we're suspended. Now, lines go up from this to a point up here, a certain place. Thank you, Marjorie. And so we're suspended by a point, and at that point is a connection with a big cargo parachute, which then goes on up, connects on up another 75 or 80 feet so to the bottom of the balloon with another single point there. And this had an effect of doing something that nobody anticipated ahead of time. But anyway, we had that big cargo parachute capable of letting the whole load. We weighed 2,000, I think, about 2,200 pounds when we loaded this all up with and added our own weight. And we took off at a vertical speed of 20 miles per hour because the chaps engineering the flight was delayed so long getting us into the air that Malcolm Ross was scared of the lateral winds. As soon as the balloon clears the mine was, 600 or so feet deep with vertical walls. We're in an expired iron mine, vertical walls, and we're at the bottom. And so he wondered, he was scared that as soon as the balloon is up there, the late afternoon winds, which build up always, will blow the thing sideways and dash us against the walls of the pit. So his notion was to put extra helium into the balloon, more than he ordinarily would, it gave us a major lift, free lift of about, I think, 500 pounds, which was a lot of extra lift. And it had the effect, though, of doing just what he anticipated, getting us the heck out of that pit, this long string balloon parachute gondola, getting us out of there in a hurry. And we did, 20 miles an hour. Then what he failed to do was to let go with a lot of that helium and slow down our rate of ascent to a much smaller rate. Well, the balloons are rigid balloons. They're not expandable or flexible. So at altitude, the balloon is a beautiful ball. I think ours was 75 feet in diameter. Just a beautiful ball. There is an open pipe at the bottom of the balloon. It was designed, the size of this ball and all, was designed and fitted to take us up, have lift enough to get us to the tropopause. And then if it went above the tropopause, the expanding helium at lower air pressures, the helium inside of the balloon is going to expand, and it'll bleed off through this open pipe at the bottom. And that will keep us from going any higher. And we would then slow down and stop rising by the time we got up there, or after we might bounce through it, but we should settle back down and be essentially at design for holding the proper amount of gas to match the air, to match the weight of our load. And this was all engineered into the construction of the balloon, and then the loading of the amount of weight that we put on the trip. And so this means that the balloon, when it takes off, is just a little bubble of helium up in the top of this great big flaccid bag with a very odd shape to the bag. And when you're going that fast, you've now got an airfoil, and so the thing is winding up. So the balloon isn't going up straight, it's going up like this. And this is something that Mal Ross never dreamed of. He'd never met it in his experience because he had never launched from inside an iron mine before, and never faced this lateral wind problem, never thought about it. And so it never occurred to him what was happening to that balloon overhead. Well, that twist was mostly taken up with this long cargo parachute and its shrouds. So it meant that the parachute shrouds was wound up. There was no way in God's heaven that if we'd ever needed to use that parachute, he would have been able to deploy and done any good to us. We would have just come down. And that, of course, is what indeed happened to these Air Force experiments using balloons that all failed. When the balloon burst, the parachute that they provided wasn't able to do any good, and their balloon, their loads always crashed. And we would have crashed. Mal Ross, he thought that the parachute was such a wonderful feature. He was head of this balloon program, really, and he was the one that called for the parachute, and then that appealed to all of the engineers and others in the services. But the parachute was a snare and delusion. But anyway, he was so sure it was the useful thing. Each of us carried a personal parachute, but he said, "Nook," he said, if something happens and it bursts, we're going to come down on the cargo parachute. We'll stay with the gondola and let the cargo parachute let us down. We won't be using our personal parachutes." And I kept trying to think of that, because I needed to get free of the bounds of my personal parachute in order to function scientifically in my projects. And so I was fighting to get free, and I thought about essentially taking the parachute off, and then if I had to use it, could I link my arms in it and open the parachute and go? And I made the decision that no, I wouldn't be able to hang on by my arms if you opened it and met the snap as the thing filled and braked you. So I never unbuttoned, and that impeded my attempts to do work. It was something I hadn't counted on. But the other thing was, I had never counted on the fact that we would be rotating. We were rotating, of course, all night long. First, the thing wound up the parachute, then it rotated like the balloon was still rotating. Then when we reached altitude, and the balloon became stable, it no longer was an airfoil, so it was stable. But we were hanging from this stable thing, and now we were unwinding and then rewinding the cargo parachute shrouds. And that was going on at an amazingly high speed for a long time, essentially all night.
If you could have stuck some kind of foils out.
If we could have done it, then slowed us down. Yes, yes. It was such a silly problem and so funny.
And it seems almost anticipatable because in toys it does that too.
We should have anticipated, of course, of course.
Because there are 1,000 other things to try to figure out.
There were. And I was leaving things like all of these related to the flight. I was hoping that Ross had. But he had never gone up like that before. All of his flights had been daytime before, which meant that he launched essentially before sunrise in the morning, when there'd be no wind at all. So he was always launching from surface. And then he would be reaching altitude in the daytime. Well, this meant that his problems were solar heating, and he had serious things there. Now he was having to adapt and think about how you run a balloon when you're in the night and doing something else very different. And it was a weird experience. But nonetheless, from his point of view, this was definitely the most successful and straightforward of all of his flights. From my point of view, it had introduced problems. But we came back alive. I could greet the family once more.
I remember that. But could you see that the stars?
It was very impressive. It was magnificent. At 40,000 feet, we were 5,000 feet above the tropopause. We had to get above the tropopause for the experiment, because there was strong feeling that the tropopause is where the most violent turbulence exists in the atmosphere, and it's that turbulence there which would introduce the twinkling of starlight and the distortion of star images that we're trying to get rid of. And so we had to go up there, and it had to be, in order to get above the tropopause, 40,000 feet is. It was successful in that attempt. We had to go north because the tropopause is the seasons. The tropopause will be relatively low. We couldn't, without wearing pressure suits, we couldn't go much above 40,000 feet. We breathed pure oxygen. Breathing pure oxygen at 40,000 feet, the body picks up for its own use about the same amount of oxygen that a climber to, say, top of Mount McKinley would have without breathing anything extra. He would be, in other words, we were breathing into our bodies. The body intake of oxygen was about the amount of oxygen at 14,000 feet. In order to make that effective and in order to avoid getting hit by bends, the release of nitrogen in the blood when you have a sudden change of atmospheric pressure, nitrogen bubbles, we breathe the pure oxygen. They intended to have us breathe it for half an hour before takeoff so that the blood would be pretty well purged of nitrogen, which is the primary source of bends. Oxygen, of course, forms bubbles, but then the body is able to utilize the bubbles as fast as they form, so yeah. You don't expect to have bends when you're breathing pure oxygen. So we breathe pure oxygen, you see, at sea level, essentially at the bottom of the mine there. It was supposed to be 30 minutes to purge. Well, because of General Mills fooling around, horsing around in their management of the flight, and they're the makers of Cheerios. We breathed it instead for over 2 hours. And there's been a question of, did that do something to my lungs and things like that. Thereafter, every lung x-ray has shown a spot on the lungs. Mm-hmm. And was that due to damage possibly introduced with this balloon flight experiment? So I did have no trouble with bends, for as I'd had trouble with bends on every one of the pressure chamber tests in which I'd assimilated this same business. And the last time I'd done it, where we had taken us to 42,500 feet for just to make absolutely sure we were checking out, I got bends hit my arm, and the feeling was exactly as though I'd broken the arm. And that broken arm feeling stayed with me for 6 weeks, the healing time of you'd expect if I had broken my arm.
Yeah.
And so for me, the bends was a serious venture. Malcolm Ross wasn't bothered by it on any of the flights. He always did the pressure chamber test with me, and he had, again, had no problem with it. But that restrained us. In fact, we didn't want to wear spacesuits. It restrained us to about the 40,000 foot level. Then the need to get well above the tropopause. It restrained us to the latitude location, and that northern Minnesota was good for that. I don't know how north that this town is. I forget the name of it that we were near. And we made that. It was beautiful. 40,000 feet. We knew when we went through the tropopause instantly. We were sitting there in the gondola with clothing, which had been checked out to work at 100 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. We had Air Force inflated, great big Air Force inflated boots protecting our feet. Then layer after layer of clothing, especially manufactured for us at clothing department of the Navy in Natick, Connecticut. I'd taken a special trip up there to be measured and to discuss clothing with them. And this was clothing that had worked at the South Pole at minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit. We knew that it would be colder than that. We knew it would be at least 55, maybe 60 degrees centigrade below zero. 40 degrees centigrade and 40 degrees Fahrenheit is a crossover point.
Yeah.
they're the same. And but we thought that the 100 covers. Well, I found indeed in that last pressure chamber test that the cooling wasn't good. The it didn't protect from the cooling. But I noted that in order to run that test, we'd had a big fan generating a lot of wind. And so I said, well, with a balloon, there will be no relative wind. So there won't be that problem of wind. And so we had a wind chill factor. And I said, we won't have that. But we go through the tropopause, and I'm sitting there with my knees exposed, and instantly a sharp feeling of cold went through the clothing, just like that. And so we knew when we had the tropopause. You also knew it visually. It's a very sharp line. You get it from some high elevation plane flights, especially in winter when plane at 38,000 feet is thoroughly above the tropopause. And beautiful horizon all the way around, in all directions, just beautiful, totally clear. Sharp as all get out. You really can't see much below it, but everything above is clear. Whole sky. And for us, the sun set, went below the horizon, disappeared, and the sun had set. They were so crazily late taking off that the sun had set when we launched. And then we went tearing up, and the sun rose on the western horizon. It rose for us and came well above the horizon. We got up at 35,000, and that was where he first started really dumping helium. He may have dumped a little before, but the rate was fast. And then he dumped heavily, and he did a beautiful job of dumping the helium. We just tapered right off in our speed, and at 40,000 feet, there we were. And it parked there. We could bring it back. It might sometimes start dropping a little, and then you dump some ballast, a cup full at a time. We would dump. I would reach over, looking down, you know, could see the city. Here's Minneapolis underneath me, 5 miles away. Is it? Well, more than that, nearly eight, of course, seven on fraction. Underneath me, and I dumped the ballast over them. The ballast was sintered iron ore, about the same density as iron, but in the form of sand, rather than of either dust or solid. And so I would dump that, and it would come back to its 40,000 foot level. It's, as he said, it was a very beautifully designed balloon for us. And but we were spinning so hard, I couldn't point a telescope and get the telescope pointing the star. And then this going up fast had given me the other kind of bends. They call it abdominal bends or stomach bends. In other words, all the gases in my belly had expanded. Some of them released themselves through the rectum, and so I, of course, dirtied my underwear. And I could belch some, but I wasn't as good at belching then as I have become now. I was raised up in the household that said men never must belch. And so I had suppressed it from earliest childhood, and I found great difficulty in doing the necessary belching that one had to do to get this stomach gas out of oneself as one goes up like that. So anyway, I was suffering for quite a while stomach bends, which is one reason I wanted to release the strappings for the parachute.
Is this syndrome of distended intestine, which you find in cultures that have things against farting, whereas they don't have in them? in other cultures.
The farting seems to be one of the deep set ones, doesn't
it? Yeah.
It's interesting, just interesting. But anyway, that is a side issue. But I could observe the star twinkling, and there was just no question. Here were the stars overhead, here were bright stars next to the horizon, nothing twinkled. As far as one could see, beautiful northern lights. It was just a wonderful sight, wonderful. And the zodiacal light, of course, was great.
Which the light?
Zodiacal light. All of these little particles of dust that dominate the solar system, especially the inner solar system, they show up. If you have a very clear atmosphere, like out in the desert, like Tibet maybe, or some places like that, when the sun sets, there will be a luminous area, kind of a pyramid of luminosity, from centered on where the sun is set. What it is, of course, is the sun illuminating this interspace dust that's dominating it all. There's another effect at midnight in these same positions. If you are looking for it and have the type of clarity of atmosphere I'm demanding for this, you have a little spot of luminous light directly opposite the sun. The sun's below you, and directly opposite overhead is this little luminous spot of light again. This dust having a peculiar illumination effect, so that you see it as a spot instead of this big pile of luminous light at the sun just below the horizon to this little spot.